Hi, this is John DeLynn. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. What you're about to hear is part of an all-day workshop recorded at the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium on August 4th, 2010. The first half of the day was dedicated to navigating an LDS faith crisis in or out of the LDS Church. And the second half of the day was dedicated to navigating an LDS marriage when one of you loses their faith. Since I'm in graduate school, I put this workshop on in part to help raise money for my family's health insurance. So my initial intent was to only share this workshop with those of you who contributed financially to the podcast. However, many of you, my financial supporters, have encouraged me to go ahead and release the full workshop anyway so that all can benefit. So that's what I've decided to do. But I'm doing it with a plea. If you have not contributed to Mormon Stories and you find value in this workshop, please take a moment to contribute to Mormon Stories today at mormonstories.org, either with a one-time donation or signing up for a monthly subscription. Without this support, I cannot continue to create this content for others and for you. So thanks so much to all of you who are monthly subscribers, and please keep in touch through email at mormonstories@gmail.com. And now, on to the workshop. I hope you enjoy. So I'll just give you a really brief intro. My mom's here. Hi, Mom. I'm 40 years old. Born in the covenant, my mom tells me I'm a fifth generation. I think I'm a sixth generation, and we have arguments about which is better, to be a fifth or a sixth generation. She comes from the generation where the lower your number is, the better, and I think it's cooler to have a bigger number. But I think depending on which line you trace it through. Pioneer ancestry, had a wonderful church experience growing up, marvelous. I served a mission, went to BYU, married in the temple, and have always just been really grateful to be a member of the church, and still am. I'm still a member, still active in the church, married with four kids. And I guess I stumbled into this area through a really tough mission experience, which you can listen to if you go onto my podcast. But then when I was called to be a seminary teacher in Seattle when I worked for Microsoft, I started studying church history in depth. And I discovered this huge chasm between the narrative that I was kind of taught in seminary growing up and what the historical record actually showed. And that made me feel betrayed and lied to and deceived and sad. And my kind of whole worldview caved in. And it's been about 10 or 11 years since that happened. And I've just been trying to find my way since then. I started a podcast to try and share my journey with other people. Lots of listeners now, and I've spent the past 5 years informally counseling with people who are going through faith struggles. So I've probably counseled with over 1,000 people just in the past 5 years, either through email or phone or personal visits across the world. So that's the experience that I bring, I guess. And I actually have left my former career as a technology guy, and I'm in the second year of a PhD program at Utah State University in clinical psychology, where I hope to be a therapist for people who are struggling. So that's a brief introduction. I have to admit that that this title is not ideal. Somebody here emailed me and said it's a horrible title because it's, how to navigate a crisis of faith. And maybe there are other ways to look at it. And the best analogy that I could come up with was Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. I love the metaphor of Adam and Eve because there's sort of this situation in the Garden of Eden where Adam and Eve, they're kind of blissfully ignorant. Things are simple. They know what they're supposed to do. Life is taking care of them. And everything seems great. And this is sort of the way that some of us grow up in the church, where it's just a fantastic, wonderful, idyllic Garden of Eden experience. But we all know that Eden can't last forever. And at some point, we get cast out of the garden and life becomes complex. There are thorns and thistles and noxious weeds and bad weather and dangerous animals and all sorts of nasty things that come about. And it's easy to think of that as a horrible experience. And this is the only picture I could find of Adam and Eve sort of in their later years. And I'm pretty sure our church created this, but I'm not totally sure. But you have to ask yourself, if Adam and Eve were trying to decide
which they would have rather had at the end of their life. Would they have rather stayed here, or would they rather have had this? I think that they would be willing to give up the safety and the security and the comfort that they had originally, and would be willing to trade that for the difficulty and the complexity, but also the probably greater amounts of joy and fulfillment and satisfaction that they were able to experience in the mortal world. And I kind of think of that as what the crisis of faith offers all of us. It's not this horrible, terrible thing that's going to wreck our lives. I see it as leaving the Garden of Eden for the first time. And it's scary, and it's dangerous. But in my experience, for the people who have approached it constructively, it leads to incredible amounts of fulfillment and enlightenment and joy and meaning and purpose if you go through it. And I'm not saying leaving the church leads to that. I'm saying that going through a crisis of faith and figuring out how to rebuild and find meaning in or out of the church leads to this level of fulfillment and satisfaction for the people, I think, who approach it constructively. And it's not easy. I don't have all the answers. I did look for other interesting Adam and Eve photos, by the way. I thought that was a fun one. And then I think this is my favorite. That's Homer and Marge. Anybody know who the snake is? Can anyone tell who the snake is? Any Simpsons fans? It's Mr. Burns. And he's using a donut instead of an apple to tempt. Another analogy I think is apt, and maybe I don't want to beat this to death. We all maybe rode a tricycle when we were young, and it was safe, and it was comfortable, and it was fun. But you know, what if you were able to graduate from your tricycle and ride something a little bit more fancy? You know, which would you pick? There's some blood and crashes that sometimes you're going to confront, but there's also a lot of joy. And so maybe Lance Armstrong isn't the best example, or maybe he is, of what we're talking about. But here's a quote. I asked a bunch of my listeners and friends to just share some quotes or insights, and this is one that I really like that I thought I'd put up front. Out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars. And I don't know who said that. I should look that up. But I think that that's true. And I think that I want this presentation to be one about hope for all of us, not one of tragedy at what we're going through. Rahm Emanuel, I don't want to get into politics here, but Rahm Emanuel is fond of saying, never waste a good crisis. And I think that's another way to look at what we're experiencing. And if I had to throw my own two cents in, I think that a faith crisis can be a beautiful, wonderful gift. So let's maybe talk about a refinement of faith instead of a crisis of faith throughout the day. So for many people, the LDS church experience can be likened unto Leave It to Beaver. A lot of you won't know what that is, but it was this wonderful show where there were two young boys and wonderful parents set in the 50s where just everything was perfect and wonderful and golly gee willikers, isn't life swell? That's the Beaver Cleaver family, and this is something that Beaver Cleaver would say, gee wally, Mormonism is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that's sort of how it is for many of us. This is the Iyer family. This is just the perfect example of showing how wonderful the perfect Mormon life can be. And I actually believe that this is achievable, and I know families like this. And if everybody can have 12 kids, and all of them return missionaries, and all of them sealed in the temple, and all of them handsome and going to Harvard for their graduate work, I think that's fantastic. But it doesn't happen for everyone. And for others, the crisis of faith is like The Truman Show. Anybody seen that movie? Or The Village. Anybody seen The Village? If I'm not going to try and explain these metaphors, but for those of you who have seen these things, you can kind of get what I'm talking about. Or The Wizard of Oz, where you're able to peek behind the curtain a little bit and see that things are a little bit different than you thought. Or Pleasantville. Anybody seen Pleasantville? Yeah. See some heads nodding? And I like this metaphor a lot because the color that comes into people's lives when they kind of reach this awakening represents the type of positive enlightenment that I'm hoping that we can focus on today. Not that everybody who's in the church in a traditional mindset is dark and monochrome. I don't believe that. I'm not setting up this thing where everyone who's a believer in the church is ignorant and Pollyannish and uninformed. I don't believe that at all. But for some reason, it doesn't work for some people. And for them, I liken it unto these metaphors. And the Stepford Wives would be another example of a type of metaphor that the church can be like for some people, their church experience. And if I had to summarize what all these images sort of are trying to invoke, it's this idea that something that you once believed in, maybe in totality, didn't end up being quite what you thought it was. And to be honest, this is just maturity. Your parents end up not being what you thought they were. Your spouse maybe doesn't always end up, except for my parents. That's the one. Well, my mom. So, maybe your spouse isn't always what you thought your spouse would be. Maybe your children didn't end up like, you know. So like, this is just life. It's just dealing with complexity and the falling short of ideals. But I think if I was trying to think of the best analogy that I could think of for people that I work with every day, it'd be the parable of the Concorde, which was a really famous airplane that could reach Mach 2, 1,350 miles per hour cruising, a few hours from New York to London, luxurious and spacious, wonderful. There's the pilots, there it is flying. And the Concorde is an amazing airplane, maybe one of the best ever designed. And the only problem is, every once in a while it erupts in a ball of flames. And so if you're one of those 99% or 95% of the passengers that are able to enjoy the Concorde, it's outstanding. You're having the greatest ride of your life. But if you happen to be on the margins, maybe you're a feminist, or maybe you're gay, or maybe you're an intellectual. If you happen to fall on the margins in some way, it's not just like it's an unfortunate thing or an unpleasant thing. It can be a catastrophic thing. And so we go from Mormonism is the greatest thing since sliced bread to, help me, I'm actually on fire. And this isn't too, I mean, this is, yes, this is not realistic, but I mean, emotionally, I don't think it's too far from reality. I have people call me every day, my wife left me because I read the wrong book and she took the kids. I'm suicidal because I can't stop my attraction for people of the same sex, and I don't know what to do because I don't want to end my marriage, but I'm terribly lonely and sad and depressed, or I'm a woman and I bought the Mormon way hook, line, and sinker. I had all these opportunities, but instead I became a mother and I did everything I was told to do, but now I'm 40. My life is not what I thought it would be, and now I feel like I've wasted my life and I'm suicidal. And I get these calls 2 to 3 times a week from people. Not that it's the majority of the church, but it's some. And so, and definitely minority. But so the question that I wanted to start with to kind of frame our discussion is, what determines someone's feeling about the church? What makes some people have a wonderful experience and what makes some people want to leave it? And I think it is important to start by something that I hope you won't be bored with, but it's my quick analysis on how religions work, okay? And I'm going to just stipulate that we're putting aside the question of divine origins and absolute truth claims. This is a bit of a secular interpretation of how religions work, but I think it's important because I think there are lessons here that are important as we're trying to unravel and then reconstruct our own faith. So I think humans are born with some very basic needs. You think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They need food and shelter and air. They need some type of social network. They need a sense of identity. They want to belong to something. Oftentimes people want to be led. I remember an Elders Quorum lesson where I was trying to help some people think out of the box, and a guy raised his hand and he said, I don't want to think out of the box. I want you to tell me what I need to do, and then I want to do that. And there's a good group of people that just, that's how they want to live their life. And I don't think that that's bad. I think oftentimes that's laudable and simple and a lot less complex if you can do that. Just some people aren't able to. A lot of people need some type of meaning in their life. They want to understand why we're all here. people long for spirituality. One of the major things is people have to deal with this dichotomy of knowing that you exist and knowing that your loved ones exist, but that your life is going to end at some point, and you have to figure out, what does that mean? What's the purpose of it all? What happens when we die? We need family support in raising a family, and we need help dealing with tragedy and chaos and all sorts of horrible things. And so, as I've tried to figure out how religion works, and this is from the picture from South Park, is that charismatic leaders who may or may not be inspired by God understand how humans work. They understand that people have these needs. And they, whether it's through sincere divine revelation or whether it's through their own personal motives, they either have an experience with the divine or they claim to have an experience with the divine. Something that no one else was fortunate enough to be privy to, and we kind of just have to take their word on it. And from there, they usually try and write down their experiences in some type of scripture. And from there, if the religion's really successful, it's usually because their leader got killed in some way, and that somehow makes them even more successful. Whether it's Jesus or Moses, he kind of just disappeared, or Buddha just kind of got enlightened and taken up somewhere, or Joseph Smith. So once these leaders die, churches spring up to try and institutionalize and make policy around the core teachings of that leader. And even as soon as the church is erected, it's not staying true to the teachings of its leader because it's impossible. But churches do their best to come up with policies and guidelines to try and institutionalize what that charismatic leader came up with. So how do they gain converts? First thing they do is they create a simplified narrative of the founding of that church so that, you know, you can't tell a whole story, so you just make it really simple. You create a simple story or narrative that you can tell people in an elevator or in a 30-minute little discussion on their doorstep, and you give them a core set of doctrines or teachings to believe in. These are based on helping to resolve all those issues that I raised earlier about the human condition. And you give them some standards to follow, and maybe even a cultural identity that they can assume. And you give them a community infrastructure of support. And that's crucial. I don't think you'll have a successful religion without a successful community. And so these missionaries often target the least fortunate, the poor and the sick and the needy and the suffering, because they're least happy and they most are dealing with these issues on a day-to-day basis, whether it's death or meaning or poverty or whatever. They teach them the doctrines of the standards. They tell them the founding story. And this is the most important part. And I don't mean to offend anyone here. I'm not telling you that this is what your religious experience was. This is my best attempt at understanding religion experiences more broadly. And I'll leave it to you as to what your own experiences were. But you introduce these potential converts to this community, and you make them feel loved and embraced and accepted. Then you do something to facilitate an emotional experience with them so that they feel tears, they feel tingling, they have the hair raise up on their skin. And you associate that, you pair it in a very classically conditioned sense to the church so that they associate that emotional experience with the church and with the community and with the teachings that they experience. And once they've made that connection, then they draw the conclusion that those emotions that they felt meant that this is the church that they should join, and that this is the church where God is, and that they should be a member. And that's the anchor upon which people then commit the rest of their lives to, as I've been able to understand it. So to simplify the formula, founding story plus scripture plus a community of support plus some happy emotional experience or fulfilling, rewarding emotional experience leads to a conversion or a testimony. Yes, Glenn.
I just want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you know if the church still does the missionary training? Like, I took a class at BYU when I was there 20 years ago, and they taught us this exact thing: help the converts identify and recognize the Spirit. That when you see that they're having this emotional response, that's when you make that connection. And so it was very explicit instruction that I had. And I'm not sure if the church is still doing that with missionaries that go out today, or if they've moved to a different approach or not. I'm just curious if anybody knows.
I would say yes. I would say absolutely, yeah.
They did for you, Brian?
Yeah.
Yep. That's just, I don't know how else it would work. So what they ask for in return is some percentage of your income, usually, some time that you can dedicate to make the church successful. You have to take on the behavioral and appearance identities of the religion, because that's an important part of it. You need to be able to follow the rules and do what you're asked within reason.
Something that dawned on me in the previous slide was connecting an emotional experience to the spirit. Can you talk a little bit more about that underlying assumption that emotions and the spirit are the same thing?
Yeah.
My personal view is that they are not.
Okay, yeah.
But can you talk a little bit more about that?
I don't, you know, I'm not saying that this is truth, and that's why I tried to give that disclaimer that I'm not trying to tell you what your religious experiences have been. But this, for people who have had a crisis of faith, this has been one of the things to cause their crisis of faith. I remember when I was, you know, in my later teen years, and I was watching the Muppet movie. I was a huge Jim Henson fan. He's one of my personal heroes. And during this Muppet movie, I start crying, and the hair starts standing up on my arms, and I feel the exact same thing that I felt in youth conference testimony meeting. And I started asking, whoa, why am I feeling that when Kermit, you know, has a wonderful resolution with Miss Piggy? And to me, there was no difference in terms of how wonderful I felt. Now, I'm not trying to tell you what the spirit is and what the spirit isn't. I think it would be fun to have you try and tell me what the difference is in a way that we all could relate to. I don't think you could. I think I've been through enough of these conversations to where people try and explain the nuance of an emotional experience versus the spiritual experience. And I think that you may think that for you understand that, but I don't think you could ever say anything that would help the rest of us get that for our own personal experiences. Now, I don't want to derail our conversation by having that debate, but all I'll leave you with is I totally validate that the spirit might exist as we conceive it, and it may very well be the center of some of our personal experiences, and the rest is emotion, or the spirit uses emotion. I don't know that we can solve that here, but I do not reject that possibility, and I'm not trying to tell you that your spirit is just emotion. I think that's the best that I can offer, okay? I'm really not. But I think for people who can relate to what I'm saying about struggling with the difference between spirit and, okay. So, I mean, at least I'm not losing most of you or offending most of you as I say that. For many, this is a great bargain. I mean, life is messy. Life is ugly. You just have to look to other countries to know that life can be a disaster. And so sometimes trading a little bit of money and a little bit of time, you're actually way ahead than you would have been if you tried to make it on your own. So I think that this is a totally good deal for those in the early category, for those for whom the church experience works. So how do churches keep members? If you think about all these items that I listed, for food and shelter, our church has a welfare program. For social stuff, they have all the social activities, Relief Society, Elders Quorum, High Priest, Young Men's, Young Women's, Primary. It's fantastic. Sense of identity. I'm a Mormon, Pioneer Stock. It's my tribe. It's my heritage. It's my people. The Jews have something like this. Catholics have something like this. Muslims have something like this. It's a beautiful thing when you have it. Some sense of morality. Do we want to spend every moment of our lives trying to decide what's moral and what's not, what's ethical and what's not, how we should live and how we shouldn't? It's a lot easier if you just sort of get some basic guidelines and live by them and then enjoy your life instead of having to make some life-changing, crucial decision at each turn. For the meaning of life, we have the plan of salvation. It tells us why we're here, where we come from, where we're going. For spirituality, we have rituals and church experience and testimony meetings and general conference. For those who enjoy that stuff, I certainly do. For coping with death, we have the resurrection. We have heaven. We have eternal families. For family support, we have, you know, your wife's pregnant, casseroles for 2 weeks straight. You need all the sod laid in your front lawn. Tell the elders quorum. You have 30 people showing up at 7 p.m., and you'll have your sod laid in about, you know, 20 minutes. For dealing with tragedy and chaos, again, you've got home teachers and visiting teachers and all sorts of support. And for creativity, you have choir and music and roadshows. Well, we used to have roadshows. And all sorts of other wonderful things that help people develop their creative aspects, creative speaking, etc. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. Again, for many, it's a fantastic bargain. So if it's all so wonderful, why would anyone leave? And I shouldn't be telling you this because you're going through it. But in some sense, I'm just trying to kind of bring us all on the same page. So what makes one person believe and others leave is what that slide should say. But the two key words are function and context. So if you were to tell me the context of your lifelong and current Mormon experience and the function that the church plays in your life today, I think I'll have a pretty good shot at telling you whether you're going to leave or stay in the church. So I'll give you an example. If you're of pioneer stock, your immediate and extended family are all true believing Orthodox members of the church. You love the members of the church, and every Sunday you go, and you're just raptured in joy to see everybody. If you fit well with the culture, if you had a wonderful church experience growing up, if you're fundamentally a social person and like being with other people, if you believe the historical narrative that the church teaches you, if you view the leadership in a positive way, if your employment or your income is somehow based on your relationship with the church, or if you have a fantastic ward experience, I can tell you that probably with a 95% probability, I can predict whether you're going to remain a member of the church. Now, I'm leaving that 5% wiggle room for whoever just made that comment over here. Who is that? Okay. And you know what? Any one of these items can be enough to keep someone in the church, even when others fall down. So you can no longer believe in the historical narrative. And I've had bishops and members of stake high councils write me and say, I don't believe the church is true anymore, but it's the best thing I know. I don't think I could find something better. It would hurt all sorts of people if I left. So I'm staying. And I've got numerous people. I think wards, 10% to 30% of the members of the ward on some level don't believe everything about the church or its teachings, but stay for other reasons on this list. Either their spouse will leave them, or they just loved it growing up, or they think it's a great place to raise their kids, or they're just social, you know, or their job, or you know, they're into construction in the Salt Lake Valley, or something like that. Now let's flip it. If you are a convert and you don't have this legacy of pioneer heritage, if the members annoy the crud out of you every time you go and you wonder why you go, if you had a horrible abusive experience growing up in the church and your parents were mean and nasty and you associate all sorts of unpleasantries with the church, if you just are not social, if you just don't like being with people, if the church is causing sincere damage to a loved one, maybe you have a gay son, maybe you have, maybe you're single, and you just feel like you don't fit in. If you don't believe the church's narrative, if you view the church leadership as false or corrupt, or somehow dissatisfaction, income, you have a crummy ward, the church brings you sadness overall, these are the types of things that will make you leave, or make you want to leave. And again, any of these issues can be overcome or can be deal killers, depending on your situation. But I do have one disruptive factor that can make it so somebody who fits all those previous things that I describe, I have still found instances where someone leaves the church. And this is when. And this is why I'm a little bit less enthusiastic about, I've completely stopped recommending Stay LDS as the pathway for people that I recommend as sort of my first recommendation. So I created this site called StayLDS.com. My goal was to help people stay in the church. And what I tried to do is take a James Fowler stage 5 approach where you reinterpret all the narrative and the myth. You become a buffet Mormon where you take the things that you like and believe and you reject the things that you don't. You engage the church on your own terms. You gain confidence. And you become a happy stage 5 healthy Mormon. I've been selling that to people for years now. And as much as I want that, part of me wants that to be what helps people bridge this terrible Sophie's choice that they have to make between abandoning something that they love or that's going to cause them all sorts of pain and going into this wilderness that could be wonderful or could be disastrous. The thing that time and time again stops this solution from working with people is not that these people have been offended. It's not that these people drink alcohol or want to drink or want to cheat on their wife. It's that they don't feel like they're being honest or that they have integrity by playing the silent, complicit role of appearing active and with the program when inside they don't feel like that's really who they are. And I hate admitting this, but I've tested it so many times now that I sort of now view the stale DS approach as something that's going to work for maybe 5% of those in a major crisis of faith who really have some of those factors that I mentioned earlier lined up for them. And so, and I don't mean that it's an invalid approach. I'm still trying to make it work, and I know people who have made it work, and I'm sure many of you here have made it work, and I'm cool with that. And I don't want you to discourage you from trying that path, but I don't want to set you up, just like a leader might tell a gay person that if they just get married to a heterosexual person and have a family and go on a mission, that they'll no longer be gay. I think that's setting a lot of people up for disappointment. And I think that setting people up that this approach is going to work for them, it's not going to be the first thing that I recommend. So what are your options? Your options are to live in denial, to live in the closet, to just kind of white-knuckle your church experience and to kind of suffer in silence. How many of you are in that position right now? Anybody? Okay. How fun is it? She said, I'm having a ball.
Can you take 5 seconds for some and explain Fowler stage five just a little bit?
Sure. So I'm a horrible person to explain Fowler stages of faith, but I'll give it a go. Ignore one and two because it's basically in the childhood. Stage three is your traditional, literalistic, orthodox believer who does everything they're told, who believes everything they're told, and who's sort of with as if they're falling with an iron rod, as Richard Pohl would say. They're closing their eyes, holding fast to the iron rod, and they're going wherever the church takes them. And it works for them. And it's awesome for those for whom it works, and it worked for me for a long time. Stage four is when you have this dark night of the soul, where maybe you find out that the narrative isn't what you thought it was. Maybe it stops working for you on a functional level. Maybe you just have some other type of crisis that makes you doubt everything, not just the church's truthfulness, but maybe Jesus and maybe God and maybe everything. And it's this stage where you're just, your whole worldview is unraveled and you've got to figure out how to piece something back together again. That's Fowler stage four. And what Fowler says happens, can happen in stage five is you move away from the literal and you move more towards the metaphorical and the symbolic. And so even if you're not sure Joseph saw God and Jesus in the garden, You can enjoy that metaphor as symbolic of the type of communication you might be able to have with the divine, even if your God doesn't have 10 fingers and 10 toes, but instead it's just some warm feeling that you feel. You can still say you believe in a God because you feel some type of influence. Just 1 second. You can still believe in Jesus, even though you may not know if he existed or not. You can call him your Savior because he saved you from pain and sorrow. And so you're saying, okay, I can deal with that. And the Book of Mormon may not be historical to you because of DNA evidence or anthropological evidence or archaeological evidence, but you read it and you feel inspired and you can say, we'll learn a lot from the stories. And just like the fables and the myths that inform our children that may not be true, the church provides this beautiful structure of myth and allegory and symbolism that can provide you meaning even if you don't believe everything you're told, do everything you're told. You can kind of swim in and out and see all paths, all religious paths and even non-religious paths as ways up Mount Fuji. And this just happens to be the one that you follow, but you also can simultaneously legitimize other people's faith paths or atheistic or agnostic paths as well. If you'll step up to the mic, I'd love your question.
How do you what do you deal with people who cannot move to the symbolic stage?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what the rest of today is all about. So, option one is, then there's probably more than five, but suffer in silence, white knuckle it. The second is, and I tried this for many years, stay, but be a disruptive force. You know, when somebody says, Joseph was like a lamb to the slaughter, you raise your hand. When, you know, when somebody quotes, you know, Brigham Young's wife, you know, you say, well, there may have been more than one. And then, you know, any time that something is inaccurate or inadequate, you feel the urgency, the moral need to set everybody straight, to tell the truth, and to ruin everybody's Sabbath experience. And I don't think that's sustainable, but man, I've tried to make it sustainable. The third option is being a cafeteria Mormon, you know, which is just, you can call him a Jack Mormon, I don't know what you want to call him, but, you know, you can just say, I'm just going to do it, feels good to me, and I'm not going to worry about what people say, and just sort of on a very practical level, engage the church in ways that work for you and not sweat the small stuff. We talked about Fowler Stage 5. You can go inactive as another option, and you can become an ex-Mormon. You can resign from the church and just completely leave it altogether. So those are some of the options. And I have to tell you that this can feel like a Sophie's Choice. How many of you don't know what it means, a Sophie's Choice? Okay, Meryl Streep, 30 years ago, movie, Holocaust Germany, a woman with her two young children in a train station. Some Nazi soldiers come up and they say, I'm going to take one of your two children. You have 1 minute to pick which one. And if you don't pick one, I'm going to kill them both and you. So she, in desperation, picks one of the kids. The other one gets hauled off and gets killed in a concentration camp. And she has to live with that choice for the rest of her life. Now, I don't think that what we're experiencing is quite that dramatic. But sometimes it can feel that dramatic. It can feel kind of like a husband who's gay but married a woman and had lots of kids, and now he's 40, and he's trying to decide what to do. Do I try and find a more meaningful, fulfilled type of love that is actually more authentic to me, but then abandon my wife and kids? Or do I stay with my wife and kids, but sort of never get that type of intimacy that others get to have in their life experience? There's no good option there. I mean, there might be, but oftentimes when you're faced with that choice, it doesn't feel like there's a good option. And sometimes it can feel like that for us. So there are all sorts of factors that can determine whether this is going to work for you, and everyone's got to figure that out for themselves. Their own cost-benefit, how the church is, you know, how they're experiencing the church, whether they have kids involved, what their level of knowledge is, how much they've thought about things, how pragmatic they are. And I have to say integrity is a very important part of this. Now, I'm not saying that people with integrity leave the church, but I am saying that integrity often becomes a reason that people leave the church. But I think that there are also people who stay in the church and maintain a ton of credibility. And I think I could mention some people, and I think there's some people in this room who meet that. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.